but our relationship with those whom we give money is important to us. Just think about the different grocery store options that we have. We have Shaw's, we have Hannaford's, we have Market Basket, we have all kinds of other stores. What really distinguishes between these stores and whom we choose to give money? What about the relationship with the different places that we go buy food from? What restaurants do we go to? How about others that we trust in money, like what bank we'll give our mortgage to? How about entrusting our money for our retirement when we are in old age and can't work anymore? What distinguishes in this land where we have so many rules and so many of the services that we're offered are all the same? I give you money and you give me this in response. What dictates who we give that money to? Trust. Who deserves our money? Who can we trust with our finances? And the more we give, the more we want to know that we can trust them. And I think a good indicator of that is, what do we do when we become fearful about what's happening with our money? You get that piece of paper in the mail from your bank or from your retirement account, and it's negative. This quarter, you've lost this much money. What do you do in that moment where suddenly your hope for the future, your trust placed in this person to invest your money wisely, is checked with uncertainty? Do you pull your money away from that account immediately and say, I'm done with them? Do you act like nothing happened because you don't know anything about finances and you don't want to get a lecture from the person that is investing your money? Or do you go to that person and say, I am concerned, can you help me? This story, this passage, this true account from history is important for us this morning to understand what real faith and trust is. Because the real measure of what faith and trust is what we do in moments of uncertainty. We often look at this passage for all of its significance. We think of it as a passage that helps us think of how we are saved. We recently went through Galatians, and it says that we understand that Abraham believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness, and that we who are Gentiles can be saved by faith, like Abraham, by trusting in God. And we say, this is great. Faith is important. Faith is how we are saved. And yet, if we are honest and paying attention in this passage, we do not see in Abram a man of unwavering, unshakable faith. There is more than verse 6 in this passage. In verse 1, God comes to Abram in a vision and says, fear not. This is what I'm going to do. How does Abram respond? But God. How is this going to be? God responds and makes further promises to him. And in verse 6, it says, he believed the Lord and he counted it to him as righteousness. And God reminds him, I am the Lord who brought you out from Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess. And verse 8, but he said, O Lord, how am I to know that I shall possess it? In a passage where God receives Abram as righteous in his sight because of his faith, we see questions, we see doubts, and we see uncertainty. How can Abram believe God and ask questions like these? How can he trust and be uncertain? This passage, I think, is so very important for us in understanding what faith really is. It confronts this notion that faith is blind acceptance. It confronts this notion that faith is about what we emotionally feel with no regards to what reality is. Because let's be honest, either God is fooled here by Abram and his expression of trust when Abram really doubts and God is a fool and can be lied to and deceived, or, as the language of belief indicates, and in the Hebrew this indicates ongoing trust, that it is not a contradiction to trust and yet be uncertain. As we will walk through this passage, I am going to say that this passage is not a paradox, but it is paradigmatic for the way that we view faith. Because biblical faith, saving faith, is trusting faith. Faith that trusts enough to admit our lack of knowledge, to admit our lack of understanding, to admit our lack of certainty, and trust God. By admitting that uncertainty, by bringing those questions to Him. In fact, if everyone who expressed uncertainty or requested to know more from God was punished in Scripture, then we would not have had Moses, we would not have Habakkuk, we would not have Peter, we would not have Thomas. Saving faith, as described in the Westminster Shorter Catechism, is receiving and resting on Christ. It is a trust in the character of our God, not in our ability to fully understand all that He is doing or everything that is happening around us. So as we come to this passage, particularly in a Reformed and Presbyterian church, we love to talk about the fact that God covenants. Here in this passage, it tells us that God makes a covenant with Abram, and we get excited when we want to parse all the pieces of the covenants, and we want to compare them to all the other covenants, and that's important for our understanding. But the thing is, God is not the only one who covenants. Kings covenant. Spouses covenant. The good news about the fact that God enters into covenant is that He's different than all those other people. The good news that God enters into a promissory relationship with others is in the character of who He is. That is the good news to the Hebrews who are hearing this as they wait to go into the promised land. This was good news to David as he needed to defeat the enemies of God's people to establish the kingdom. This was good news to the exiles. This was good news to those who returned from exile. And this is good news for us this morning, the character of the God who covenants. So we'll ask, who is this God who makes covenant relationship with Abram and with us? Who is the God that we can trust even in the midst of our uncertainty, even with our uncertainty? First, as we look through this passage, we see that the God who covenants is a God who knows. Notice in verse 1 that God speaks first. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, "Fear not." And if you weren't here with us last week, we looked at chapter 14 where Abram has this daring, powerful military victory, becomes wealthy and powerful, and gives it all away. In an act of trust and dependence on God. And yet in this passage, it reveals the fact that as God comes and speaks to Abram, even though Abram has given no voice to that fear, that God knows him and knows what's on his heart. He knows that he is fearful, and what God says speaks directly to those fears. "Fear not, Abram, I am your shield." That word shield refers back to verse 20 of chapter 14 where it says he delivered him. It's the same root. Abram had this great victory, but he gave it all away. He gave away the people whom he would build an army with, the finances that would make him a great king or be able to finance a great army. He's given that all away, and God is saying, "I will be your shield." And your reward shall be very great. That word reward is a military term. It's loot. It's the things that you get when you're victorious in a military campaign. And God is saying, all those things you just gave away, do not fear. I will restore them to you. I will provide for you. God demonstrates that he knows God's concern, that he knows Abram's concerns from the very beginning. God comes to Abram knowing his state, his questions, his uncertainties. He knows the heart behind Abram's questions. Abram is asking, Lord, you say I'm going to be a great nation. I'm going to have all these offspring, but the only person I have as an heir is my servant Eliezer. How is this going to happen? Then God shows him the fact and tells him the fact that he's going to have a biological son, and then he takes him out and shows him the stars. And then Abram asks this other question, how will I know that I take possession of the land? He is asking God, show me that this is going to happen. And yet God knows the heart of Abram's questions, not challenges, but seeking, asking, admitting helplessness. Deuteronomy 6 says, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. But there is a difference between testing God and saying, God, prove yourself, and admitting that we are tested by what he tells us. God knows the heart of Abram and so graciously answers that heart with further encouragement, with further revelation, acknowledging his need for assurance. He gives him visuals of the stars. He gives him the concrete nature of the covenant ceremony, acknowledging that Abram is flesh and blood. He is human. He lives in a tangible world where touch and taste and smell matter. And so he gives him these visible signs, knowing his weakness, knowing what will help him understand. Psalm 78 says, God remembers that we are but flesh. A wind passes and comes not again. God knows Abram. He knows the uncertainties already in his heart. He knows the questions, and he knows us where we are before we even admit it. I think this confronts for us that we oftentimes are caught in an arrogance of saying God can't possibly understand. I am hurting so bad. I am so afraid right now. God can't understand that. And in the midst of pain, we can be deceived to believe such things, but this passage confronts us with the reality that whatever pain, whatever uncertainty, whatever weakness we have, God already knows. And when we acknowledge that God understands us and that God understands all, even as we don't, he doesn't leave us in ignorance. That he is a God who not only knows, but in his knowledge chooses to reveal to us what he is doing. We see that in this passage. Abram says, God, what are you doing? How am I to know that this is happening? And what does God do in response to that question? He reveals more of the plan. He says, first, that he's going to have a biological child. Abram has been wondering, what is going to happen? I'm old. My wife Sarah is old. She's been childless for decades. How am I going to become a great nation? And God reveals to him how it's going to happen. He reveals the timing of his plan for the future generations. He says, this is what's going to happen to your children. I am going to provide for you a great number of children. They're going to come through your own biological line, but it's not going to be easy. And he warns Abram of the path that his children are going to have to tread. That they're going to be sojourners in another land, that they will be servants there, that they will be afflicted for 400 years. God reveals, and he reveals honestly, who he is and what he is doing and what's going to happen. Now, that doesn't mean that God tells us everything. God doesn't tell Abram that his children are going to be particularly oppressed by Egypt, but he gives him knowledge of what is necessary so that he can step forward in faith. It reminds us that what God reveals is true and trustworthy, that it is for our well-being to help us in knowing him, to help us in trusting, to help us in confronting difficult situations with trust. Abram goes to him with his questions, and what does God do? Does he close himself off? Does he hide himself away? He uses Abram's uncertainty, his doubts, and his questions as an opportunity to reveal who he is all the more to the one that seeks him. And in that honesty, trust is built up that even if circumstances are difficult, even if uncertainty comes from what is happening around, that Abram then can be confident in who God is because he is a God that saves. And when we read in Scripture to save, there is a wide range of meaning. And this passage actually speaks to that range of the different types of salvation we experience from God. First of all, salvation, to be saved, can be purely physical. It can be to be delivered out of a harmful situation. And that's what God is promising. I am going to be your shield. I am going to protect you from your enemies. And he's also going to protect his children from their enemies. He will deliver the children out of bondage. Salvation cannot be only purely deliverance from a physical harm, but out of a place of oppression. His children will walk in another land. They will be under the influence of others, but God will bring them out of that place of oppression. In fact, when we see that this covenant ceremony is going on, in verse 11 it says, and when birds of prey came down on the carcass, Abram drove them away. And we're like, why is that little detail in there? And we'll talk about this more as we go through the passage a little bit further. But those animals that Abram was specifically commanded to go and collect for the purpose of this covenant ceremony were clean animals. They are acceptable animals. And these birds of prey, these vultures, these are unclean animals. And so in the act of driving off the unclean animals from the clean animals is a picture of God saving his people from the nations. Abram unwittingly, as he begins to enact this ceremony, is being used of God to remind Abram and to remind the future generations that God will protect them from their enemies. But it is more than physical protection. It is also spiritual salvation. Verse 6 says, and he believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. To be acceptable in God's eyes when we would otherwise not be comes because of God's choice to receive and accept us. Abram does not do anything worthy of acceptance here. All he does is trust in the truth and validity of what God says. But God is gracious to us to save us. God saves us as we depend on him. This speaks a bit to the nature of faith, not as a work, but dependence. Note the passivity of Abram. God has him set up this covenant ceremony. But it is God who enacts the ceremony. As the sun was going down in verse 12, a deep sleep fell on Abram. And behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. And then the Lord reveals, gives him this revelation of what he's going to do. Abram is passed out. He is oppressed by the darkness, and God is the one acting. In verse 17, it says, when the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking firepot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. Abram is doing nothing. God is the one moving through the pieces. And in verse 18, it says, on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram. God is the one who saves, not us. And sometimes, if we are not feeling like our faith is strong, like we fully understand, we will begin to question whether we are worthy of God's love. We will begin to question whether we can come into his presence, and then we will run away from his grace. Whereas in this passage, we see that if God is the one who saves us, faith is an invitation to draw closer to him and what he accomplishes, even in the midst of our uncertainty and our inability. So it is good news that he not only saves, but in our insecurity and on our uncertainty, he is committed to that work of salvation. The very nature of a covenant is a promise. It's an oath. It sets expectations. We often refer to marriage as a covenant, and one of the reasons we do that is because in a marriage ceremony, a man and a woman publicly declare their vows before witnesses of what their intent is, because they are enacting a promise, a difficult promise to fulfill. And so they are making that promise known to everyone who would bear witness to what they are promising to do because of how important it is. That's what a covenant does. It expresses commitment publicly and tangibly. And God has here expressed commitment to bless Abram, a commitment to give him descendants, to rescue his descendants from bondage, to give his descendants this land. It's interesting to note, not only does God make commitments, but he expresses them to us. Isn't that interesting? God, in all of his power and glory, God who is omniscient and all-powerful, not only commits to us, but tells us he is committed to us. He wants us to be comforted by the fact, even as he does so here with Abram. Does God need this ceremony to bind him? Does God need a cloud of witnesses to hold God accountable? No. In this enactment of the covenant, God is comforting Abram. He's comforting the Hebrews. He's comforting us with the ability to know how deep his commitment is to us, that we are worthy of his love such that he would make public vows to us. He dignifies Abram and us by allowing us to be witnesses to his commitment. The grounds of our relationship to him is not based on our commitment, but his. Is it God's commitment or ours that results in our salvation and our hope? It's God's. Notice what verse 18 says. We may not pay attention to it because it has the list of all of these enemies and we read over that. But at the very beginning of what God says to Abram, he says, "To your offspring I give this land." It does not say, "I will give this land." And in fact, the English there is a little bit weak because it would be better represented as saying, "I have given this land." Are these enemies still there? Yes. Does Abram have descendants yet? No. God is saying, "I have accomplished it." So willing is he to make a commitment before Abram that he describes it as having already been accomplished. God's commitment, particularly his commitment to save, entails our dependence and not our achievement, because he is the one that accomplishes it. And when we understand that God is committed to us, we do not need to fear to confess our uncertainty. We do not need to fear to express our questions, our fears, or even to confess our sins. To even say to God, "This is what I have done to you. This is how I have rebelled. This is what I have done to my spouse or my child or my neighbor." If God is not committed to us, we have reason to fear that his love might change, that his kindness, his choice to save us might change. But if he has committed to us, as we see in his word now, then even the worst things that we have done can be an opportunity to receive his commitment afresh as we acknowledge them and receive his grace afresh. So committed to us is he that he sent his only son to die for us to accomplish the salvation necessary to fulfill this promise. So committed was he that he allowed his son to shed his own blood for us. Let me confront something about this passage. You have maybe heard that as God appears in the form of a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch and passes between these pieces, God is saying, if I don't fulfill my promise to you, may it be to me like these pieces. Basically, God's saying, would I be torn apart and be killed like these animals if I don't fulfill these promises? There are some wise scholars who have this opinion on the passage. And I think that the impetus, the motivation is good, but you can't get it from this passage. But that does not mean there is any less commitment. The very fact that covenants were celebrated and inaugurated with the shedding of blood was to show how serious the people were. They're spending big money. They're putting their money where their mouth is to make a commitment, saying, this commitment is so worthwhile that I will shed blood as representative of life to make it happen. And it's better here to understand that these animals sacrificed are not to represent what will happen to God, but they are to be representative of the future people of God that God will be with. Because what he's offering is not the comfort of, will I die if I don't fulfill my promises? But he is offering his commitment to be near Abram's offspring. That what he's showing as he passes through those pieces that represent the people of God is his commitment to draw near. All the commentators agree as they read through this that the smoke and the fire is symbolic of God's presence. The people who would have heard this the first time who came out of Egypt would have seen Mount Sinai clothed in fire and smoke when God appeared to Moses. And Isaiah 4 gives us a picture of the great day of the Lord when he comes to make his presence known among his people. And in Isaiah 4, it says this, in that day the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land shall be pride and honor of the survivors of Israel. This is a great and glorious day. And he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy, everyone who has been recorded for life in Jerusalem. And when the Lord shall have washed away the filth of the daughters of Zion, cleansed the bloodstains of Jerusalem from the midst of it, then the Lord will create over the whole place of Mount Zion a cloud by day and smoke and the shining of flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a canopy. There will be a shade for day from the heat, and for a refuge and a shelter from the storm and the rain. The ultimate good news to us is that God gives himself to us. He promises to be present to us. He has never forsaken us in our sin, but allowed his son to be forsaken for our sin, that he would open up the path for us to be restored to God. His son came and walked among us to save us because he knew us and our sin. And even as Jesus ascended into heaven, he sent his spirit, not an impersonal force of magic, but the third person of the Godhead. He sent his spirit so that we would know the presence of God with us always. Until Revelation 21, when it says, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. The God who covenants with us is a God who knows, a God who reveals what he knows, a God who saves us, a God who commits to us, and a God who draws near to us with his very self. What does that mean for us? two things. First, comfort. If you are uncertain, if you are doubting right now, that does not remove your relationship with God. But the revelation of who He is should draw you in trust to express that to Him, even as Abram expresses his questions and his doubts to God. That doesn't mean things will be comfortable. I want to distinguish between comfort and being comfortable. Because what we receive in trusting God is Himself. It doesn't mean every circumstance that raises our questions and our doubts will suddenly be wiped away. In fact, as it was revealed to Abram, some of what God reveals will be difficult. But in admitting our uncertainty, we have the comfort of God Himself. And the second thing is worship. Because we worship primarily not out of where we are in the moment, but in response to who God is. If we were to only worship when we felt good, if we were to only worship when we felt without sin, if we had been loving our spouse well, we would never worship, brothers and sisters. But if we understand that the basis of worship is who God is, we can come with doubts, we can come with questions, we can come with sins and bring them all to the foot of the cross. And hear the words of Jesus saying, "It is finished." Our trust is in the God who covenants with Abram, who covenants with Israel, and all who put their faith in His Son. Would we trust in Him, even with our doubts? Let's pray.